Hopefully, many of you have already read a bit about our service today, either in our announcements that have been posted on the UUFB listserv or in the e-news. Chalica is a week-long celebration that is unique to Unitarian Universalism. Each year, this tradition begins on the first Monday of December and concludes with a service the following Sunday, which is today. Chalica is a wonderful way to deepen our engagement with the seven principles. Each day of this past week, those of you who've been participating lit a chalice and reflected on the meaning of that day's principle. Some of you may even have done something specific to honor that principle. I'd like to point out that in RE class, the children made the lovely flags for our seven principles, for our parade of principles today. A good number of you took Marie up on the offer to receive text or email reminders about which principle would be the focus of contemplation for the following day. Both Marie and I are delighted that several of you have agreed to share your thoughts and experiences with the congregation during today's service. Now, as we are gathered to commemorate our week of Chalica, let us begin the sharing of insights and awareness gained about the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. As each person comes up, I ask them to light one of the chalices before they speak about the principle they will be speaking on. And now, I invite Bob Sterling to come up to the podium and begin the sharing as he speaks about our first principle. Deanna Dean and Tanya Stevens will follow Bob and share about the second and third principles, respectively.
I'm able to stand in this spot, in this wonderful space that we have, is because about 55 or 60 years ago, I made a decision to change my life. Like many of you and myself, I was on a quest to find some path to spirituality, redemption, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it. So I had been going to Christian churches all my life. I was trying very hard to believe everything they were telling me. And I finally decided that I couldn't believe it. I couldn't accept the notion that I was born in sin, that I was innately evil, and that the only way I could achieve redemption was to believe what somebody told me to believe. I suspect that most of you are in the same boat. Am I right? So, the reason that we are all here, or another reason that we are all here, is that because some time ago, a group of very wise religious scholars got together and, having the same concerns and feelings that we had, decided to talk about religion a little bit. And they said, well, after all, hey, what's the point of all this religion? What's it all about? And they mulled this over for a while and talked it over. And they finally all agreed that religion, per se, is the pursuit of enlightenment by human beings, period. And the path that you take to receive this enlightenment is through a theological or theistic dogmatic program. And they said, well, wait a minute. Says, we're the humans in this piece. Why should we do that? Why can't we put this whole thing together and do it ourselves? And so they sat down and attempted to come up with a system of religion that created a separate path, a different path for people to take in their quest. So they took all of our weaknesses and all our vulnerabilities and our frailties and our imperfections and put them in a box along with our incredible diversity and our capacity for love and understanding, and put the lid on the box and shook it all up, let it all get mixed together. They opened the lid, poured it out on the table, took a look at it, says, hey man, we can do this. we can turn our fate over to human beings, as imperfect as they are, and have them take a different path to redemption. Because they felt the same way I did. They didn't agree with the theistic program that they were on. So this thing is lying on the table. I said, okay, humans, here it is. What are you going to do with it? It says, it's up to you to get on this path and figure out what you want to do. That moment was a very transcendental moment, because what it did was offer a different path for redemption than had ever been done before. What they said was that human beings can take charge of their own destiny, come up with the right answers, act properly, and the result is that you have lived a loving, compassionate life and a rewarding life. So they said, okay, come on, hop on this wagon, we'll get on the path and ready to go. He says, well, by the way, we also threw 7 beacons in the box before we shook it up. Each beacon signifies a direction to go in certain circumstances so that it makes your trip easier. And so, people got started. And they found that instead of being evil, instead of being nasty, they had the capacity to be welcoming, acceptable, accepting, loving, compassionate, and it was easy, as opposed to the or else situation that is presented to you by the other path. So anyway, each of these beacons that were thrown in the box represents a principle of behavior that we should live by to achieve our goal of enlightenment. The first of these beacons sheds light on the assertion that we're all in this together, We are not evil. We were born with worth and dignity. Now, I'm going to go along with you guys that I was troubled and struggled with the way that the first principle is written in our set of principles, which states that you affirm and promote the inherent worth of every person. On the face of it, that's a very difficult thing to do, because we know that there are a lot of people that don't do that, and they're doing some really nasty, evil things in the world. But when you think about it, and I think if I had been among that group of scholars coming up with these seven principles, that I may have worded it a little differently. But the meaning, in my mind, is that we are not born in sin. We are not evil. We are actually pretty good folks. So we get on the path and we light that first beacon. And it sheds light on this principle. And it asks us to affirm and promote that everyone has value, has worth, has dignity, is good, and not bad. By accepting and affirming and promoting this first principle, you turn on the other six lights. Stay tuned.
Our lovely podium was made. They accounted for people a little short. I'm talking about principle number two, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And the children's side of it is be kind in all you do. Justice means in accordance with moral rightness or fair treatment. Equity, of course, comes from the same root as equal, so it means equal treatment. And compassion is acting with sympathy. You have probably seen the bumper sticker that says, "No justice, no peace." And when you think about it, that really holds true. The world would be so much better for all of us if justice prevailed. Certainly for those who receive better treatment, and also for the rest of us, because lack of justice breeds resentment and desire for revenge and leads to more injustice. And, you know, if you're interested in history at all, you can think of how many episodes of injustice that have led to more injustice all along the years. In our children's song, principle number two is be kind in all you do. So I was anticipating that the children might be here, but I'll talk to you as if you're children. But we might share our toys and our crayons. We might invite a new kid to sit at our table at lunch or join a game on the playground. And we adults can amend that to our lives too. Children will see good examples in our congregation. We bring food to the food bank, we volunteer for Family Promise and the Fork and Spoon Cafe, and these are important to so many people who are struggling in their lives. Recently, we collected things from diapers to household items for refugees in Missoula, and those people are having a really tough time, but our compassion may help them ease their time a little bit. I have been on the receiving end of this congregation's generosity. 7 years ago, after abruptly ending an abusive marriage, I was setting up my own place, and I was working, so I could afford some things, but to this day, I am using the furniture and the vacuum cleaner that kind people here passed on to me. And one of these days, maybe I'll get a new one and pass on the old ones that are still working to someone else. I'm in a better place now, emotionally and financially, so I try to pass it on as I can. Recently, I decided to get a new recliner chair. I had a decent chair, but I sat in one that a friend had bought, and that was nice. So I decided I needed a new one too. I haven't bought much new furniture, so I was thinking about the delivery guys. Do you tip them? I asked around, and some said no, they're already getting paid. Some said yes, give them a few dollars. And then I thought of our friend, Bill Weifenbach. As it became difficult for him to get around, some people here visited him, and he really appreciated that. I started giving him rides to church when the Staubers were not able to do that. And then I'd give him rides to appointments or shopping or just drives in the country, which he really loved. To thank me, he'd often take me to lunch, and I discovered that he gave very generous tips. He said that servers were not paid much, so he wanted to help them where he could. So, back to the chair delivery. With Bill's example in mind, I did tip them generously. I figured that furniture delivery guys could probably use a few extra dollars too. And one last thought. When I was a child, my dad would often tell me that I should have respect for the rights of others. And I was a meek and mild child, but he told me that so often that it stuck in my craw, and I got so I was really tired of hearing it. But still came the sermon, respect for the rights of others. But I learned that lesson, which is really another way to state our second principle, if you think about it. However, nobody ever told me that others should respect my rights too, or even that I myself should respect my rights. I want all of us, and especially the kids, to know that while we are being kind to everybody else, we also need to be kind to ourselves.
Hi. I am speaking about principle 3. We're free to learn together. When I was in the fourth grade in public school in Kentucky, the teacher used to come every Monday and say, "Who was in Sunday school yesterday?" And I would raise my hand lying every single Monday. My father was an atheist. My mother was a Catholic. We couldn't find a place that they agreed upon, so I didn't go to a Sunday school. I did not feel free to learn. And this is the way in our third principle that we state it to our children. We're free to learn together. I wasn't free to learn together in that situation, but I am now. Our third principle is also stated acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. As a humanist, I have to dig deep to define spiritual growth for myself. Yet, since I've been at this fellowship, I've experienced a change in myself that I have decided is exactly that, spiritual growth. And like any born-again, remade person, I have no compunction holding myself back from encouraging others to find what I found, and that is acceptance of one another and spiritual growth. From a Reverend Rob Hardy, He says, spiritual growth isn't about a vertical ascent to heaven, but about growth in every dimension at once. It's spirituality in 3D. Growth in spirit doesn't measure one's proximity to a God above, but rather the spaciousness of one's own soul, its volume, its capacity, its size. Well, so now I have to define soul. But I have no doubt that as I find myself on this journey into 3D, that I will come to define that as well.
We will hear from Georgia and Mandy Jor regarding our fourth principle, and they will be followed by Susan Backer, Lee McGill, and Nadia Polotsky.
So I'm Mandy Jory, and this is my daughter Georgia, and I realize we're going on our fourth year coming here, but I usually sit along the side and sneak out. Don't say a whole lot, so I'm glad that Mr. Lee got me and Georgia. Georgia will maybe chime in later if you feel comfortable, but we're talking about the fourth principle today, which is the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And thinking about this, I'm realizing that truth is not real straightforward. But I'm going to just talk about some conversations we've had in our family and a little bit of history and how we've found the truth in our family. So starting out with my parents, they're here, Joel and Larry, you may have met them, but they grew up in a small town in Minnesota. We're raised Lutheran, and we're told what the truth was, as far as religion goes, that is. And they told me about some sort of pyramid that they were shown at some point where Lutherans were at the top. And I don't know, the other religions were kind of spaced down the pyramid, and I think Muslims were on there somewhere, but definitely near the bottom. And so I guess the top being you're right next to Jesus or God, or something like that. So that's kind of the background there. But my parents were thinkers. They did end up going to college, and even at Concordia Lutheran College, I guess they taught logic somewhere along the way. So they were thinking about things, and my dad was still on the road to becoming a Lutheran pastor at this point, and was teaching a Sunday school class, and said something to the effect of, you can't take everything in the Bible literally. That didn't go over real well. And it changed the course of his life. So he did end up at the University of Washington studying Chinese history with Ted Bundy, but that's a different story. So, anyway. Sorry, Dad. Okay. So growing up, my sister and I, we weren't told in our household what to believe or what was true about religious beliefs. Anyway, we come to that on our own, but we were sent to Catholic school. So that had a bit of an effect. And then we moved to Minnesota somewhere along the line when we were still growing up. And then we had to go to Lutheran church. And we were told that it was so we could fit in. So there was a late baptism, a first communion, and confirmation, all kind of back to back. So we got a late start, but we did it so we could fit in. And I kind of tried to buy into that until I was 13 and I read a book by James Michener called The Source. And that kind of put a kibosh on any of the beliefs I was being taught at church. So I'm thankful that I was allowed to seek my own truth, and my sister was ahead of me. She was an atheist, and then I was an agnostic, I guess, after reading that book. I couldn't quite say atheist. But we discussed these at home, but not outside of home, and we were told to not say we were atheist or agnostic outside of the house. Kind of a secret. So now coming to talking with my own daughter about truth can be uncomfortable and complicated. Thanks to this community, there is an answer. Like the fourth principle is that we can search for truth and we can find it and for ourselves. I'm glad the word responsible is in there. And when George and I were talking about this, she had some things to say, and if you want to say them, you can. Do you want to say?
The truth is hard.
The truth can be hard. And is there any particular things you want to share with everybody? Would you like me to? Okay. So, yeah, I mean, Georgia's had to learn some things early on that are hard. So about her father, I won't go into details, but that's one thing. But we, on a maybe less serious note, there's Santa Claus. I won't go into details. But, you know, that can be a difficult truth. And then also, I hadn't thought of this till I saw Laura this morning, but our whole lives, we did partake in that when she was in first grade. And she shared some of that truth and knowledge with her playmates at recess, and it didn't go over real well. I did get a call from the teacher, so to tell her that was not something you share. So, but we talked about it, and it's all okay now. I mean, and I think this year some of the kids do know the truth. So anyway, I think truth can be hard, it can also be beautiful. Nature and science and snowflakes and all people have their own truth. That's important, and I think in our family, learning to be accepting of that fact, that everyone has their own truth, to be humble, not judgmental. And it's an ongoing challenge, but that's our experience with the fourth principle.
I lit that fifth candle for our fifth principle, which states the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. And the children's version, each person needs a vote. First of all, I want to thank Marie Lynn and those who organized the Chalukah celebration again this year. I found it a lovely way to reflect on these fundamental values of our faith. Sometimes it's a long time, I found that it become easy to take these deceptively simple statements for granted. However, lighting the chalice each morning and reading and thinking about the principle of the day brings me back to why I embraced this faith some 40 years ago. I also find starting the day with the quiet lighting of a candle is a calming antidote to the frenetic pace and excess of this holiday season. Let's start with each person needs a vote. When you stop and think about it, this principle flows right out of the first principle. We believe that each person should have a voice because of the worth and dignity of every individual. Every person is important. In our families, in our schools, in our churches, and in our country, every voice is valuable. Before decisions are made, careful thought should go into them by everyone involved. We know that we don't always get our way, but we also know that it's important to share our opinions about how things should happen. I thought about our church meetings as well with this principle. When we were a much smaller congregation, the annual meetings could easily take half a day or longer because smaller decisions hadn't been made by committees and the board. As we've grown, some of that intimacy of small group decision making has been lost, giving us efficiency, surely, but losing some of the individual voices if careful, thoughtful communication hasn't taken place. I hadn't thought too much before about what the first part of that principle says, the right of conscience. In the words of UU minister Kenneth W. Collier, he says, "My conscience is not simply a matter of conditioned response to stimulus. It is far deeper. It is the way my being, my very self, responds to the world around me. If I'm repulsed by some things and moved by others, that tells me how I am connected with everything. It tells me how I must promote the well-being of all. It tells me that I am responsible for all and how to exercise that responsibility while still retaining the humility to recognize that even though most people agree with me, I may be wrong. I may be reading the still small voice of conscience incorrectly." We all have that still small voice of conscience in us that acts as a sort of moral compass, telling us what's right, what's wrong. Part of growing up and maturing is learning to listen for that voice and to trust that voice, even in the middle of difficulties and deep questioning. I promised myself with this principle that I wouldn't get into the political, although it's deeply embedded in this principle, and I couldn't do it because there was not time. However, I would like to recommend you this small book to you. It's called Our Seven Principles in Story and Verse, and it's by the fellow that I quoted, who is a UU minister. And it's Our UU Seven Principles in Story and Verse, a collection for children and adults. And although it was written in the 1990s, his discussion of failures in our government to honor the democratic method and process is really pertinent for today. I'd like to end with another quote from him. "How can there be a democratic spirit without this sense of conscience? Unitarian Universalists believe in the democratic method, not because it's the most practical form of government, it surely isn't, or because we think that somehow the will of the majority is magically right, which manifestly is not the case. We believe in the democratic spirit because we believe in the right and the exercise of conscience. We believe in the democratic spirit because we believe that there's no other way to safeguard the right of conscience, and its unfettered exercise. We believe in the democratic spirit because we believe that privilege, inequality, and oppressive hierarchy are immoral, irreligious, and if you will, sinful. It's hypocritical to uphold the inherent worth and dignity of all and the right of conscience while supporting privilege and the suppression of minority." Happy to loan this out to anyone.
So I've lit the sixth chalice here in honor of our sixth principle, which is to build a fair and peaceful world, or to affirm and promote the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Now this sounds like a pretty lofty and daunting goal, but to be a little cliche, every journey of 1,000 miles always starts with a single step. So even our journey to the moon not too long ago seemed pretty daunting, but we were able to make it when we all worked together. And to start off, it's usually good to just start with ourselves and with our small group, our little community here. Meditation is a great way to find an inner peace. And once you find that inner peace, you can start to share it with others until hopefully we can have a pandemic of peace across the world. A few other little things that you could possibly do. Amnesty International has lots of letter writing campaigns, and you can always try to find a way to volunteer or donate to other worldwide organizations such as UNICEF or Doctors Without Borders. All of these are really great things that can help us achieve this goal. And just to save on a little bit of time, I'd like to end this with a quote by Jeff Liebman, that we are only as free as the most fettered among us. So, thank you.
Wonderful sharing. Wonderful sharing. There we go. Turn the microphone on. Thank you all for sharing your thoughts and your reflections about our seven principles. You've definitely given us food for thought.